The total weight of evidence actually that was used to form this idea were, I think, six or seven case studies. A case study is usually an observation of one person. So that's the total data out of 7 or 8 billion people. It's six or seven case histories where someone asserted that a person who was positive by PCR, but according to the report, had no symptoms, managed to infect someone else nearby. I mean, and when they infected them, it was only that they became PCR positive too. Now, I think the vast majority of these were out of China, interestingly, and I'm afraid anything that's influential that comes out of research in China is approved by the party. I'm afraid that's just the way it's always been. And there was only one substantial claim for asymptomatic transmission in Europe, and I believe it was a subject that had come from China and visited a number of engineering plants in Germany, and it was claimed they infected, you know, a lot of people, even though they were, quote, asymptomatic. But apparently, very quickly after that report, it was corrected that the person actually was heavily symptomatic and had been using over-the-counter medicines to try and get through their day. So it really was symptomatic after all. And just like someone with flu or a cold, they'd barreled on through their day and they just had managed to infect people. But I can explain to people very simply why it's not just my opinion and that of other people that asymptomatic transmission isn't true. I can show you by reasoning. In order to be a good source of infectious virus, say it's me, I have to have a lot of virus in my airway. I can't infect you at a distance if I've got a tiny amount. That's because the world's full of pathogens all the time, and you're able to fight them off routinely, minute by minute, throughout your whole life. You have to have an amount, over an amount, such that it becomes an infective dose. And that only happens if you're in close contact with someone who's emitting lots of virus. And in order to be emitting lots of virus, you have to have a lot of them in your body. If you have a lot of viruses in your body, you will have symptoms. It's simply not possible for you to have a high viral load and for that virus to be attacking you and you have no symptoms, and for your immune system to be fighting back and protecting you and for you to have no symptoms. It's simply not possible. There might be a brief period of a few hours when the virus is growing quickly, the body's just starting to respond. You might not quite notice, you might not feel 100%, you're not ill yet. That's called pre-symptomatic. And yeah, I guess it's possible a few people were infected that way. But the idea that transmission, a major contribution to epidemic spreading, occurred in a person that was full of virus and had no symptoms, it's just bunk. And I'll just add one other thing that I think will chime with people, that we are very good at noticing whether someone's a health threat to us, usually a respiratory threat to us. When you come up to a person, a relative or a stranger, without trying, you scan them and you're aware, is their gait normal? Is their head normal? Are they looking at you clear-eyed? Or do they look hunched and a little bit ill? And without thinking about it, if you don't know them and they look a bit ill, you will skirt around them. In a sense, you're socially distanced unconsciously. And so the two things I've just said there, in order to be a good infectious source, you have to be yourself full of virus and you will be symptomatic. The only chance you would accompany, you would encounter someone like that in your community would be, I think, still averted, because if you saw someone stumbling around full of flu or a cold, you'd think, oh my God, you know, get around this person. So it's my contention that there was almost no transmission in the community because there weren't symptomatic people. They would be feeling ill if they were in that situation. So there were hardly any infectious contacts in the general community. And you know what? That explains why lockdowns systematically across the world haven't done anything. And that's because the places where you do encounter symptomatic infectious people are where they've no choice to be there, either hospitals or care homes or occasionally your own domestic environment. Everywhere else, you simply won't find infectious sources. So when you lock down and smash the economy and civil society, well, of course you don't lower transmission. It wasn't taking place there. Obviously not. So that's where I am on asymptomatic transmission. But yes, you're right. It is a manufactured story. And it was on that basis that we're all told to wear masks, which don't work anyway. So even if it was true asymptomatic transmission, masks don't work anyway because they've been tested repeatedly over the years and they don't do anything against respiratory viruses. And that was the justification as well for mass testing. Millions of people who had no symptoms. And of course, as I said early on, when you use tests en masse, a fraction of them will be positive even when the virus is absent. And if you don't take account of that, you'll think, lo and behold, there's all these millions of people who have this virus, and they better be, you know, self-isolating for days or weeks. This whole thing has terrified people, and it's all a lie. I don't think a single fundamental sort of driving fact about this epidemic has been represented correctly. And it's obvious to experienced scientists like me. And when I've spoken to lots of my peers, they agree. So it's not like I'm an unusual person in thinking as I do. What's unusual is that I have come out and said so. And most of my colleagues have more or less said, you know, my employer or my university doesn't want me to say anything that would be counter to the official line, so I'm just staying quiet. Whereas I decided I wasn't going to do that because something very bad is happening and it's getting darker.
Now, I want to get back to this question of censorship and self-censorship, but this idea that healthy people can't get other healthy people sick, even, you know, okay, the few pre-symptomatic cases notwithstanding, there seems to be not just basic common sense to that idea, but it seems that epidemiologists, immunologists, virologists, the world over, doctors, regular MDs, would understand that intuitively based on their experience and in so many ways. How can we account for the general silence of so many of your colleagues and the medical community in general?
Yeah, so yes, I can't explain why the vast majority of people who definitely know better have chosen to remain silent. I don't know. What I can tell you is anyone, me included, who said things like I'm saying, which is there were problems, for example, with the PCR test in UK, and I would comment about it and write articles about it. What I did notice is that immediately you did that, and the more qualified you are, the worse it was, you would be attacked, for example, on Twitter and eventually on main media. So, for example, last year, the main UK broadcaster, the British Broadcasting Corporation, actually used well-known journalists to slander me in public. A lady called Emma Barnett, who runs the Woman's Hour podcast, I'll name you Emma because you named me, and she made some statements about things I had not said that slandered me. And on that occasion, I told her she better take that lie back or I would sue, and they did indeed delete that portion. So basically, they intimidate you, and they'll use either, I think, employed people on social media, who do exist, to attack you. And sometimes professional colleagues, one way or another, have, you know, just taken a different view on, they will attack you. And no one gets on any of the main media that doesn't have a view that accords with what the government is saying. So I don't know whether they really believe it or not. I think some do, and they're a bit thoughtless. But I think, to answer your question, people were a bit uncertain whether they were going to say anything or not, noticed that anyone who said anything got attacked, slandered, called a conspiracy theorist or a fool or wrong, or a COVID-iot, someone who put other people's lives at risk. The accusations were endless. Well, the thing is, I'm not doing this for money. I have suffered injuries, shall we say, to my reputation and my finances for speaking out. But I'm very confident in my position. And so, once you've arrived at that view, you know that attacks are manufactured. And so, you know, it's like they used to say about warfare, when you're over the target, that's when the flak is heaviest. So I think a lot of people, you know, I'm not in their head, so I don't know, but I think a lot of people chose to say nothing out of self-preservation, cowardice perhaps, or pragmatically, they realised they would just be destroyed. So, and that's that. I do think the origin in Britain we have a regulator of broadcasting in this country called Ofcom. I can't remember what it stands for, Office of Communications, something like that. And on the day of the first lockdown, March 23rd last year, they issued a four-page guidance that said more or less, we expect all broadcasters, and that includes radio, TV, newspapers, to not say things that contradict the position of the government or their authorised health advisers, pretty much. Didn't quite say censorship, but it said, you know, this is an emergency and we you know, it's not going to be appropriate for you to, you know, give the option of publicity to viewpoints that challenge that. And that still continues now. And we're about, 55, 56 weeks into this emergency. So they laid a marker down pretty quickly and nobody on the main media pretty much said anything at all other than the government's official position. And I think people noticed within a few weeks it was, that's not tolerated. So now we've had probably 11 and a half months of a single party line, and anyone who says anything knows they'll be attacked. So it's easy to understand why it's continued. I actually am not able to answer your first question. Why is it that people didn't say something before the example of attacks had started? And I don't know. But I do know that friends of mine, some former friends actually, who damn well knew that what was being said was a lie, and I asked for help and they said, you know, I'm not going to, because it will threaten my position with the university and I won't get grants from certain granting bodies. So yeah, plenty of people just self-preservation, cowardice, or as I say, maybe they were just pragmatists, because I haven't got very far. My reward for trying to speak out has just been, I'm pretty much extinguished as a professional scientist.
Well, I've seen this happening again and again. We've seen it happening all over the world. You know, we've seen it happening to eminent epidemiologists like John Ioannidis, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, the provisions that you're talking about that the British official censors have put in have been, of course, repeated throughout social media, YouTube, Twitter, et cetera. And we've experienced it ourselves on this channel. And I want to thank you, by the way, for taking the risk that you've taken. And I can tell you that it's much appreciated by many people all over the world and will continue to be. Let's hope it does some good. I want to give you a sample from a recent British publication. They call it the Summary of Modeling of Easing Roadmap, Step 2. And this is a short excerpt that I think is very telling. It's buried in this document. It's on page 10. Don't know if you've seen it yet, but this is going back to the vaccine. It says, "The resurgence in both hospitalizations and deaths is dominated by those that have received two doses of the vaccine, comprising around 60% and 70% of the wave, respectively. This can be attributed to the high levels of uptake in the most at-risk age groups, such that immunization failures account for more serious illness than unvaccinated individuals." This is discussed further in paragraphs 55 and 56. Well, what do you make of this? This seems to be an admission that people who have gotten their full complement of vaccine are more at risk of the wild virus or who knows what, some immune-dependent enhancement, antibody-dependent enhancement. It's unclear what exactly they're saying, but they're essentially, it seems, admitting that if you've been vaccinated, you're now at greater danger of dying.
Yeah, I didn't read it like that. I mean, just a few things. Remember, these are models. They're models. Please, for God's sake, people. They're not chicken entrails. They don't have a time machine, right? They're not predictions of the future. What they are is mathematical models. And the product of mathematical models, essentially, is like a sausage factory. What you throw in one end and you turn the handle and a product comes out. So they're just telling you that they think if there's another wave, the subjects that would fall ill would come from the groups that you just described. I don't think they're necessarily saying that will happen, because if they are, I will ask them, if I was in this room, how the hell would you know that? You know, so I don't know why they produced that forecast. It just looks like nonsense. But all of their models have been nonsense. It's very strange that I've never seen that modelling group go back and say, this is what we said will happen, here's what happens, and this is why you should have confidence in our forecast. And of course, the reason they haven't done that is that none of the forecasts have been even faintly close to the outturn. So, you know, I'm afraid our world seems to be being destroyed by credulous people paying attention to mathematical model as projections as to what will happen. What I would say is, if the vaccine is effective, and certainly the trials purport to show that, and I'm not in a position to say that that's not true, although I know some people say it's not true, but if the vaccines are effective, it's not possible to get what's called epidemic spreading. It doesn't matter, even if there were 20%, say, who are vulnerable, they might be vaccination failures. A percentage of people vaccinated don't become immune. That's true. But it would be very unlikely that they would acquire the virus, because how could they? As I just described 10 minutes ago, they would need to encounter a source of infectiousness, and there's very little of it, and there are very few people who could be it. So I don't even understand the assumptions they've used in this most recent model that could possibly produce that outcome.